Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. I'm Jo.
And I'm Jerry, and this is podcast 4A from series 3. Last podcast, we discussed language as part of our B podcasts, where we look at a topic and try to identify some learning for social work practice. And we've had some feedback from people. So the principal social worker in Cornwall has said that the podcasts are a useful platform for reflection, self-awareness and discussion, and that she'll be promoting them with colleagues in Cornwall, which is great. And they've also been shared by Change for Social Work UK. And we've had some kind of conversational feedback as well, haven't we, Jo, about our style, things like that.
We have. Somebody observing that we tend to sound as if we've got something to teach, I guess, was you know, that, and that sometimes that can make us a bit formal. So we thought we'd go for a more informal type style today and try to be more conversational. But the thing is this, Jerry, I've got to be honest, I love the learning points. I do, and I don't want to lose them. So every now and again, while we're in the middle of chatting, I am going to stop and read some of our stuff out because I just think that it's great. So,
okay, and somewhere between being too formal and swearing a lot is probably the exactly right mix. And please keep letting us know what you think by talking to us if you see us, or letting us know on the website www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or commenting on iTunes or LinkedIn or our Facebook page.
Yeah, and today we're going to be talking about assessment again. And I think that, you know, this is part of the exploration we're making through the social work journey. And we started with contact, and we're going to go right through to the closure of our work with somebody. And we have already talked about assessment in terms of gathering information, but this time we really want to talk about what you do when you've gathered all the information. And for me, this is the absolute critical part. We know that social workers are really good at gathering information. It's about how do we analyze it and make a judgment. We know that it's not all done in neat steps. And we know that there's a point where we've got to stop gathering and we have to conclude. And so that's what we want to explore today.
Yes, and actually it's quite positive, I think, that we need people to conclude. Let's say we need people to conclude, that social work isn't something that you can, where you can feed information into a machine and it comes out with a nice, neat answer. There is a need for professional judgment, and there's also a need for that professional judgment to be absolutely centered on the person and the family, the situation that it's about. So there's a real kind of human relational element to the conclusion as well. It's not kind of cold analysis.
It just did spark for me that thing about the fact that there has been some attempt to involve IT in making algorithms, hasn't there, for child protection. And I know that one of the councils down south were trying that out.
Yeah, and what we've tended to find, and this happened with adult social care as well, with making decisions about budgets, kind of feeding in levels of need and seeing what comes out. Where there are algorithms and they're really evidence-informed, they can help, but they don't replace professional judgment. And the ideal really is a very well evidence-informed tool that is used capably and that allows room for the professional judgment. And I think we are getting better in social care, certainly in adults' social work, at making sure that whatever we're using for our assessment has a really clear element at the end, which is, what is your analysis? What is your professional judgment? So that we don't end up with lots and lots of information and then not concluding, or leaving it to a tool to tell us what to do.
And I would echo that in children's services. I would say that we've got a lot of really robust evidence-based tools that we use well and sometimes not well. And that the biggest issue, I think, that would still come out would be how well we analyze and making sure that our judgment can be backed up by all the information we gathered, because there still seems to sometimes be a disconnect between what it is we're saying has to happen and the reasons why we've drawn that conclusion.
And we're going to talk a bit about judgment now, aren't we? We said that we would start off by defining well, giving a definition of professional judgment, the helpful one that I use is from Brian Taylor, which is in Professional Decision Making in Social Work Practice. And that definition says that professional judgment is when a professional considers the evidence about a client or family situation in light of professional knowledge to reach a conclusion or recommendation. And actually, this has come up recently, hasn't it, in a court case as yes. to what constitutes judgment, how expert we are, that kind of.
Yeah, I think this is so timely. Anybody who reads Community Care Inform will have seen that on the last 2 days we've had two articles, one from David Shemmings and the other that started it all off with a headline that says attachment theory evidence not admissible in care order cases judge rules. Now that's how it starts off, but as you read it, and it's really worth a read, the judge has got lots of concerns, and I don't know that he's exactly saying that we shouldn't use attachment theory evidence ever, but he wants to talk about how expert evidence can be admissible in civil proceedings. And he says, this is Mostyn, Judge Mostyn, he says, for expert evidence to be admissible in civil proceedings, it must be contained within a recognised body of expertise governed by recognised standards and rules of conduct relevant to the question which the court has to decide. And I would argue that social work fits that, mm-hmm. and that if we're trying to decide where a child should live, a social worker would have that in their remit, and we're definitely governed by standards and rules of conduct. And it would be of such a nature that a person without instruction or experience in the area of knowledge or human experience would not be able to form a sound judgment on the matter without the assistance of a witness possessing special knowledge or experience in the area. Mm. And once again, I would argue that a social worker most certainly could be a person who possessed special knowledge and experience.
And I quite like that it's experience as well as knowledge. So we're not saying a social worker might know a situation really, really well, have professional standards and think about something relevant, and then have to go off and ask the expert kind of holder of knowledge about it, that they could, their experience combined with knowledge that they could gather might make them the expert.
What the judge is saying here is if you're wanting to classify attachment behaviour, which David Shemmings in his article, which is also worth reading alongside, he talks about the fact that to actually be able to classify different types of attachment, you need to have gone through quite a lot of training. And so you do need to have a kind of developed an academic and theoretical expertise as well as that experiential expertise. Mm-hmm. And what he says is people should really be thinking about what is the relationship and talking about the relationship and the meaning that they attach to that.
Yeah. And this is a kind of slightly contested area of expertise, isn't it?
Most definitely.
And I think the principles, though, that we are regulated and therefore have a level of trust placed in us as professionals, and that we would look for something that's relevant and we'd use knowledge and experience to make a judgment about it, are absolutely fine. I think then it's just being really careful that we know that we've got sufficient knowledge and experience to speak beyond what somebody would be able to say if they just happened upon that information or happened to know the situation, which I think is kind of the judge's issue, isn't it? Because there's more in the judgment about how the research was used as well.
Yes, that's right, Jerry. What the judge said here was that the local authority's evidence against the mother was extremely long and included generalised criticism. He said that it lacked any concrete examples of where and how the mother's parenting could have been deficient. And I think really what he's talking about there for me is the analysis and the way that the statement helped the social worker link what she'd seen and what she knew and what sense she was making of it to the recommendation she was making. And I think sometimes that can happen. We can get overwhelmed with the amount of information and the amount of complication in a case. And when we go to write it, mm-hmm. it tends to lack the clarity that somebody's looking for.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we've thought about this before, haven't we, obviously? But so those articles from 26th, 27th of June, they do also fit with something that we were going to mention today, which was a judgment that was given about social work expertise in court, which is cited by Wall 2000. And that says that you can be judged to be expert if you give an objective, independent, well-researched, thorough opinion, which takes account of all relevant information and represents the genuine professional view on the issues submitted. So it's that, again, it's the expectation of the standard of objectivity and thoroughness and analysis. And well, research tends to mean not just picking a bit of research, but looking at different sides to a question. And then coming to a really clear conclusion. But I really like the thing that you were saying about linking the conclusion back to the sense made, back to what we know and what we observed and what we learned.
Yes.
So that there's a really clear line from I've met this parent to, and therefore I conclude, that takes us through the meaning.
I think that's right. And I believe I have met many, many, many social workers who are able to do that. And I've met some who struggle, and sometimes I've been the social worker who's able to do it, and sometimes I've been the social worker who struggles. But I would really hate to see us move back from having confidence, the confidence that the PLO, the Public Law Outline, invited us to have as experts in our own right.
And it is really important that we have confidence in our analysis, not just about what we know and why, but also what we don't know and why, and what the but this is our best conclusion, and there are some outstanding issues if there are, because if we don't acknowledge our biases or the gaps in the information or the potential for the uncertainty to become clear in ways that we didn't expect, then firstly there's a concern that we haven't actually recognized those things, so it's a healthy thing to think about that in our judgment, just to make sure that we have thought about it. Also, when someone else comes along to look at, or we come back to look at what we concluded and why, the doubt, if the doubt's not in there, then we can be really surprised if things turn out differently. And I think making clear where the doubt lies as well is just good practice for when you come back to reappraise the situation.
I think that's right. And it's about also, you know, we offer up our judgment, and we talk clearly about why we think what we think. We realize it's contextual and it's time bound, because every judgment is time bound. You know, it's just a picture of what we've got right now. And so therefore it will always be open to challenge, won't it? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and we should welcome that challenge. If ever there was a field for scrutiny, then this is the field, isn't it? I think that it's good to be challenged, but what we have to be able to do is really think about the child and as much as possible, or the vulnerable adult, the person we're working with, the service user, and as much as possible try to link back all our statements to what we understand and know and have heard from them.
Because actually you've just made me think of something that came up the other day when I was doing a recording workshop. And one of the things that came up was that people said that they wrote more if there was likely to be a challenge, because you needed to explain yourself more clearly. And that made me think, actually, the people who are least likely to challenge are the people we need to explain ourselves most to, because they're the most powerless and they won't be able to challenge us. So we've got to be even more careful and thorough about making sure they really understand where we've come from.
And also the length of writing more doesn't protect you from anything, actually, because if you write lots and lots and lots, which is what happened in this court case, actually, there was probably a very knowledgeable worker there. We don't know at all what the situational context was like for the worker in this case. But sometimes when you write lots, it can look as if you don't know what you're thinking. For me, it's about clarity. You need to understand why these words matter. Who would they matter to? What's the purpose of them? What are you hoping to gain from writing them? And how are you demonstrating that your assertions mm-hmm. or your opinions actually have some foundation that can be tested?
And there were some things we talked about in the recording workshop, which I think are quite relevant as well, around making sure that the person is properly involved. And I suppose the principle, the sort of rule of thumb, is that people shouldn't be surprised by something that's written about them. And if there is something in there that's going to be contested, or that there's not a consensus about, there's disagreement over, or that is potentially painful or difficult for that person to read, something that we need to include because it's really important and we've included it as carefully and sensitively as we can, and it still needs to be in there. So, for example, maybe about the amount of alcohol that somebody uses, that we've talked to them about that beforehand so that they're not looking at something and being surprised. And it may well be, you know, one of the things we talked about was that you would have to sit down with the person and talk them through what's going to be there, make sure that there's no surprises, and share it with them in that way, rather than in adult services, we often send out assessments and that might be what you get. That's what you see. And it's just trying to make sure that the person feels fully involved and that their views are fully represented. Even if in the professional judgment, you're saying, I don't agree with this person's perception of the situation. My perception, my opinion is this.
Well, when we talked about ethics just before, and if you think about ethics, you know, we need our judgments to be grounded, don't we, in the past, the present and the future. We need to be able to show how the situation arose, how it unfolds, where it'll go. And we need to be able to demonstrate that we've had all of those conversations as thoughtfully as we can with everybody involved. And I like some of the work that you've done around thinking about those, the ethics of judgment in performance management. For me, it's really helpful for us to think, okay, well, when I get a peer audit, for example, or when I have a live case audit, or when there's something about performance, let's think about the same things. Was I fully involved? Did the audit feel consistent? So, you know, did the manager treat all the staff like this? Did it feel impartial? Did it feel accurate? Was I able to correct or contribute to it? And was I treated with respect and dignity? And I think that those questions are exactly the same type of questions that our service users want to ask. When people make a judgment about you, you feel like you want to be able to test it. And you want to be able to understand where that judgment's come from.
Yes, and actually thinking about how it feels yourself is really helpful. One of the exercises we try and do is have people look at an assessor's conclusion and think about how it would feel if they're reading it about themselves.
Well, we've all experienced judgment, haven't we, of some kind or another. We really want to come to an understanding together in partnership of what has to happen next in someone's lives. And I think you're right. We may not always agree with the client or the service user, the young person, the child, but they need to understand why we think what we do. It's that transparency. So
some of the skills that come out really clearly in the research, but also when we see it, we know that's a good assessor. Things like self-awareness, being able to question, being curious and reflective.
Yeah, and I think the one that stands out for me around self-awareness is that willingness to ask for help. I just think, honestly, you are so ahead of the game in life if you know how to ask for help and you know how to take it when it's offered to you. Because actually, I think the reason that we struggle with analysis and decision-making is because they are genuinely very difficult things for us to do.
And that goes for asking for help from information as well. People who go and look up the law, or will go back to relationship-based social work practice, or will get some research about the impact of dementia.
Read the case file history if there's one.
Yeah.
Properly. Yeah.
Yeah, but then you do need a level of confidence, don't you, that if you're doing that and you're not rushing about, that you're working. And we had this conversation again with recording, that people were saying, and when they're writing up their assessments, they sometimes feel like they're not working, they're just catching up on work, or finishing stuff off, but the big work's done. And I really think it's important to see the record as part of the assessment. It's still an opportunity for analysis and insight and reflection. And sometimes you can work through writing something up and think, I've just noticed a really big gap here, or actually I feel like I'm contradicting myself, or I'm not quite sure about this bit. And it's an opportunity to test out your thinking as well as to write it up for someone else.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I still love the assessment framework. And I know that it's not trendy to do so. So I do apologize in advance to everyone out there who's throwing their shoes at me. But the thing is this, for me, it's an anchor for me to go around and ask myself, do I know anything about this part of the child's life? Do I know anything about this part of the parent's responsibilities, capabilities, or anything? Do I know this part about where they live? Do I? And I don't feel like I have to slavishly fill in every box, because I'm no believer in that at all. But I do think it's really useful to have touch points in your head. And if you don't know a piece of information, why don't you? Just ask that question, not, oh, I need to run back out and get it.
Yeah.
But should I? Does it matter that I don't know it?
And that fits with sense making, doesn't it? Because analysis means breaking things down and figuring out how they fit and figuring out what's the most important bits, what's underlying something else, what the root cause of stuff is, what's an effect, all that thing. But when you come to writing your conclusion, you're doing synthesis, aren't you? You're sense making and putting that stuff all back together into a conclusion.
And for me, Jerry, the thing about what we've just been talking about is this really critical element in the analysis, which is that in the assessment process, you need to leave as much time for your writing up and your synthesizing as you do for the actual collecting of the information. And one of the things that I think often happens is that people spend all the available time they have, because we're often working to really difficult time frames, they spend all that time collecting information, going out for visits, doing direct work, when they can, reading files, doing all sorts of things. So they're gathering. And then they don't have the same amount of time left to actually synthesize, test, and really check up on their conclusions. And ideally, you would want to write your assessment, write your judgment, and have enough time to take that into supervision and have your supervisor test it with you, or take it to your core group, or take it back to your family and really test it out and then have another go at it. And I think we kind of miss that step.
Yes. And in adult services, sometimes the expectation is, often the expectation is, that you get one visit with people, and that makes that kind of approach really difficult. But I do like the principle of having the time for analysis and concluding. So if you've only got a day, or you've only got half a day, you've only got 2 hours, which I used to have in intermediate care because I had to go out that day and do 3 assessments, then you do need to make sure that you don't take up all the time on gathering. And actually that really fits with doing good research or doing a good evaluation. Yeah, if I've got 10 days to do an evaluation, I'll need 5 days of that for analysis and writing up. And ideally, I'd want half a day or a day to go back and see the person and talk it through. There's another parallel with research, actually, that I was just thinking about, which is in social sciences, there's been a lot of effort to make the researcher really evident in research. So if we are looking at a problem, looking at a question, gathering information, following a methodology to try to answer it, and reporting our findings and our conclusions and recommendations, which is essentially what we do in assessment as well, that we would start by introducing who we are. So the little bit of research that I've done, I've said what my age is and my gender and my cultural background and why I'm involved in this at all, what my professional kind of qualifications are, what I think is important. And we don't really put ourselves into assessments quite in that way. And maybe we shouldn't quite in that way. But there is something to be said for being really clear about who you are.
I think that's just perfect for me. It's in giving a kind of statement about who you are, you're revealing some things that may need to be tested or thought about. You know, that could be helpful. And perhaps, as you say, if that doesn't end up in the final document, perhaps it's something you could bring into the supervision room and just say, you know, I just want to check. This is my pen sketch of the people I'm working with, and this is where I think I'm the same, and this is where I think I'm different.
Yeah.
So that you can at least have a conversation about how you are impacting on the people you're working with, which of course we know we are. And of course our judgments are formed of our own practice, wisdom and experience, as well as our knowledge. And our knowledge base has a bias to it as well.
Yeah.
Like the way a social worker looks at the world is not the same as how an engineer looks at the world or how an anthropologist looks at the world. Or we know that. That's why we try and have multi-agency meetings. So there's a bias to our knowledge. It's not – our knowledge isn't free of any sort of slants. And so I think it's really good to try and remember that when you're making a judgment.
So we said that we would try and finish up with some enablers. Think things that would help us. We have talked about individual skills, and there is an element of this that is practice and seeking mentors, seeking people that can help you learn, watching other people do it well, having opportunities to get feedback, those kind of things. Alongside that, you do need to be in a good state to make a good judgment. So individual well-being, which includes physical wellness, not being too tired, not being too rushed, not being too preoccupied, includes not being too stressed.
Not being too hot, Jerry.
yes.
Just topically
not
today.
Not being too hungry.
You know, really, not being too hot, not being too hungry. Yeah,
and we absolutely can't rush these. And where we feel, I think, under pressure and not thinking clearly, it's really important to seek support. The other thing, obviously, is the context that we're working in, how much support we get, and this issue that Munro talks about around a learning culture, not a compliance culture.
Well, actually, when Eileen Munro first started talking about how we would understand time, and that we wouldn't use time in this kind of, you know, we would do the right thing, not do things right. She was talking about us taking each individual case and looking at its merits and taking up to 45 days to make a judgment. In my professional judgment, this is as much as I can say in 1 hour. This is as much as I can say in 2 days. This is as much as I can say in a month. With the time I've had and the work I've been able to do, these are the things I've been able to understand. So this is what I can say about it. And that's our job. Mm. Our job is not to have the right answer. Our job is to be able to demonstrate that proportionately, given what resource and what time we've been able to allocate, this is what we've been able to come back understanding, knowing, thinking about and recommending. Yeah. And it would be really great if our supervisors could talk to us in that way so that we felt confident to do that.
I really like that idea of saying who we are, this is how much time we've done, this is what we've been able to do, and this is what we have found out and what we think it means, rather than trying to present it always as ta-da, this is the answer. We probably need to conclude.
We do.
One of the things I
See
thought about beforehand,
have a conversation.
it's still relevant, actually. One of the things I thought about beforehand was this idea that when we're making judgments, we have to be comfortable enough with them, but we do also need to be uncomfortable at the same time. So we shouldn't ever feel like we've got someone else's life. It's always open to question and open to challenge. We've got to be ready to adapt our view, but we need to be trying to get to a point where we feel able to say something constructive that helps us make progress.
People are giving us the best amount of information they can on the day we ask them in the context of which they're living. And that's the limit, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the major reflective question or reflective point for me from all of this is, how do we keep aware of where our expertise comes from, but also what the limits of it are, and be prepared to ask for help at those limits.
Yeah. And for me, it would be what affects my judgments day to day and what's affecting the judgment of the people that I'm working with.